Connected. Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Back in June, the U.S. Department of Agriculture approved the first lab-grown or cultured chicken meat for commercial sale. It's the first cultured meat to be approved in the U.S. It's grown from animal stem cells. No actual animals died in the making of the meat. Don't look for it in the grocery store just yet. So far, it's only available in selected restaurants. And this is different from the veggie meat alternatives you might have seen, maybe eaten, that are based on different kinds of plant or mushroom proteins. A Wisconsin meat science expert joins us now for a look at the science behind the new products and some of the challenges in bringing it to wider markets. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Coming up in just a bit, we want to hear, would you eat lab-grown meat if it became available to you? If you are a vegetarian for whatever reason, is this something you think would count as vegetarian? Are you looking forward to this or not? If you eat meat currently, would you want this in the mix? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeff Sindelar is professor and extension meat specialist in the Department of Animal and Dairy Sciences at UW-Madison. Jeff, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Before this news from the USDA permitting this stuff, you had looked into this some and wrote an information thing about this cultured meat, and you wrote that this is new to us, but the technology, the basic technology behind it, has been around for a long time. Can you talk about that a little?
Absolutely, I would love to. So the technology behind cell meat or cell-based meats has been around for around 20 years. It started out very slowly, and has grown into the industry that it is today. However, the process for working with cells in this fashion has been happening for well over 100 years, and it's been utilized for lots of different purposes. One of those has been to help develop vaccines and means for treating diseases such as polio.
Now let's talk about the process here. First of all, what kind of animal cells can be the starting point for this cultured meat?
Sure. So really any type of animal cell, or excuse me, any type of animal that possesses cells that are ideal for being good candidates to generate and create these cell-based products or these cell-cultivated products. And when I say that, I mean that right, we need cells, or in order to be successful in this technology, cells need to be identified that are able to provide the products that are necessary to create a desirable and successful cell-cultivated product, right? So kind of to use an analogy, right, if we want to feed a baby versus feed an adult, we have to think about different types of food, right? And really foods that we're feeding a baby, we're trying to nurture that baby so that they grow and proliferate and are very healthy and strong, as opposed to foods that we feed to normal healthy adults. The same concept is really important to be applied to the cells that are chosen, selected, and nurtured for a proliferation and growth into these cell-based products.
So skipping ahead a bit, Jeff, I've taken this cell from a chicken. I have a bunch of undifferentiated chicken cells now. How do we turn that into something that you and I might recognize on our plate? What does it take to take these cells and make something that looks like, I don't know, a chicken breast, or when that comes along, a pork chop or something like that?
Yeah, no, great question. So this is what has been the topic of interest in heavy research for the past, in development for the past 20 plus years. So it takes a group of people with different expertise in cell biology, biochemistry, chemical engineering, analytical chemistry, as well as meat and food science, who with their different backgrounds and knowledge and skill sets can come together and tackle these challenges. But it really starts with those cells, right? Oftentimes they're things like stem cells or these cells, right, that are selected that have specific properties that they can grow and grow quickly and have the ability to adapt to the environment of the development as well as the cultivation. Those cells then are combined with some type of media, and the media is rich in a variety of things such as essential amino acids and different macro and micronutrients as well as growth factors. Those cells are combined with that media, cultured media, in a bioreactor, so a very controlled environment where it's sterile, warm, right, and very conducive for growth. And then over a matter of a few days to a few weeks, enough of those of cell growth occurs, which is called biomass, to be able to start having enough cell stuff, for lack of a better word, that can then be either transformed into some type of ground product or go through some additional steps where it is put into like a lattice or a structure that can then be grown and developed into something that might look like a chicken steak or a pork steak or beef steak or something like that.
One of the hopes for this in the long run, if and when this becomes something that can be done at scale, is that it could be overall environmentally a plus compared to the way we get meat now, you know, raising animals in the environment. The thing you just described sounds like a lot of work, fairly energy intensive. What would it take to get from where we are now in this early stage to something where this is a net environmental gain? And I know there's a lot of different ways to measure that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't think that the answer to that question is clear at all as of today, because there's a lot of things that have to be understood, right? The cell-cultivated industry, that technology is still pretty young, and it's really developing, and it's developing very, very quickly, right? and it's to a point where we'll start to better understand, I think, that question in the next 5, 10, maybe 15 years. But right now, it's really unclear whether cell-cultivated products are more environmentally friendly or less environmentally friendly than the traditional animal agriculture routes.
Talking to Jeff Sindelar. He is a professor and extension meat specialist in the Department of Animal Sciences, Animal and Dairy Sciences, I should say, at UW-Madison. Talk about the idea of cultured meat products that start with the cell. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Jeff, I'm trying to figure out who regulates this and how it could be regulated. And I'm guessing people in the industry and people in the government are trying to answer some of those questions. What do we know at this point?
For sure. Regulation is one of the many questions and one of the many hurdles for this technology. All are achievable, right? As of now, there are two companies in the U.S. that are approved to manufacture these products, to produce these products. The regulation for these products are handled jointly by FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, as well as the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture. And essentially, the FDA, since they oversee biotechnology, bioengineering, ingredients, and so forth, they regulate up to a point until cell proliferation or growth of those cells occurs. At that point, USDA takes over regulation, and then they do everything thereafter, which also includes food safety and labeling.
Now, Jeff, as I mentioned at the outset, it's just this cultured chicken product so far. Do you anticipate seeing other birds coming down the pipeline, mammals, cows, pigs, goats, and so on, fish? What are you watching for next when it comes to the product lines that we might see?
Yeah, another great question. So for sure, right, chicken is on the market now. I fully expect other species, right? Everything that we see in the grocery store, right, beef, pork, lamb, poultry, anything that's protein-based, I think will eventually be able to be produced following these cell-cultivated technologies. Yeah, it's just a matter of time, for sure.
Jeff, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for the questions.
That's Jeff Sindelar, professor and extension meat specialist in the Department of Animal and Dairy Sciences at UW-Madison. We talked to him about some of the science and the process behind lab-grown meats, also called cultured meats, what it would take to bring it to wider markets. Now we want to hear from you. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Would you eat this, if it were available in your neck of the woods? Is this something you want? Vegetarians, vegans, would this fit your diet? Yes, no, or you're trying to figure that out if you currently eat meat. Are you interested in these alternatives? Do you like plant-based protein products that, you know, fill in that spot where we might put meat otherwise? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about lab-grown meat or cultured meat. There is a chicken product on the market now in select restaurants. Won't be coming to Wisconsin probably for a while, but we're opening things up for you now. Let us know your thoughts on the idea at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about the ethics of, you know, the way we grow meat now, the way we get it now, its impact on the environment? Does that inform whether or not you eat meat? Do you want this kind of product, cultured meat? If you're vegetarian or vegan, would you eat it? If you eat meat now, do you need it? And if you have religious restrictions on what meat you can eat or when, how do you think this fits in? I think people are trying to figure that out right now. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Greg is with us in Davis, Illinois. Greg, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Greg?
Well, the trigger was I'm a vegan, and most vegans are offended when they're conflated with vegetarians. Vegetarians obviously will eat some animal products such as eggs or cheese, and most vegans are pretty much almost 100% of vegans are going to tell you that the cruelty involved in any kind of animal agriculture is just not worth even touching. So I just want to make that distinction. I personally don't have a problem with lab-grown meat. I wouldn't eat it myself because I'm sworn off of anything that would look or taste like meat. But I don't have a problem with any vegan wanting to eat that if they are curious or what have you.
And, Greg, I'm going to ask you a question that probably you're sick of and you've heard a zillion times, but I know people, when interacting with vegans, wonder what you do instead of meat. What do you, don't you miss it? What do you do in place of it? What do you tell people?
Well, I think there are numerous meat substitutes on the market that are outstanding. For example, Burger King has the Impossible Burger. That's a meat substitute. It's designed to taste like beef to help wean people off of eating meat. So that's one example. I think its competitor, Beyond Meat, is just as good, if not better. Although the one product that I like to point out, particularly like people in Wisconsin might like, the Impossible Bratwurst is one of the best meat substitutes I've ever tasted. So there's plenty of products on the market that are good.
Greg, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. We are opening the lines up for you to share your thoughts on the idea of cultured meat products. Does it, this is like taking a cell from a chicken, that's what's on the market now, growing it, turning it into some sort of chicken-like product, cooking it up. Does that gross you out, or are you excited about that idea? Hope it comes to you soon. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tracy joins us now in Manitowoc. Tracy, hi.
Hi. I had a question as to whether or not there have been any studies done on the effect of this cultured meat on humans.
It's pretty new. The FDA has approved it, Tracy. I don't want to speak to all the science behind it. The notion, at least so far, the FDA seems to be okay with it. What do you think? Is this something you would serve up or no?
That would be a solid no for me. I mean, we don't even know if that would be something that would be healthy for us.
Gotcha. Do you look for meat substitute products at all in your life, Tracy? Or are you just fine with eating meat as is, or a little of both?
I'm actually going the opposite direction. I'm looking for more farm-grown meat, less processed, the better.
And is there any particular product you found here in Wisconsin where you're like, yes, I've got a great local source for it?
I do have some sources in Manitowoc that they grow their own pigs and their own cattle, and the meat is absolutely delicious. It costs a little bit more, but it's a great way to get your protein.
Okay. Tracy, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Dave on the Ideas Network Facebook page who says, there's plenty of venison running around my yard, eating everything in sight. Lots of fresh meat to be had. I'm guessing venison will probably be a little lower on the list, but who knows? That could come along someday. You could join that conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org or call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the idea of cultured meat. Caller on the line, but I'm not able to take them just yet, it looks like. Nope. Okay, it's still time for you to share your thoughts, though. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We've got Kathy. There we are in Milwaukee. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I might eat it. It's an interesting option because lab-grown meat is going to be a lot cleaner, free of antibiotics, and that's a big reason why I don't virtually never buy chicken right now. And I'm wondering about the cost. Is this going to be more expensive than or on the same price line of higher-grade meat?
Interesting, Kathy. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Well, we took a few calls there, but you can keep the conversation going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know your thoughts on the idea of lab-grown meat. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tour of a special cave.
Bats are an important part of Wisconsin's wildlife, but over the last decade, a fungal disease called white nose syndrome has devastated bat populations in the state and across the country. In rural Crawford County, a cave that once was a tourist attraction is now protected by the Mississippi Valley Conservancy. It's a safe haven for the bats to hibernate and help scientists develop ways to stop the disease. Most of these bats have settled in for the winter, but before they returned, WPR's Hope Kerwin traveled underground to learn more about this unique cave.
So the entrance to the cave is inside this little building. Welcome to Kickapoo Cavern. I'm Sarah Bratnober. I'm Communications Director at Mississippi Valley Conservancy. This doorway is really the only way in for people, but if you look up there, you see a little slot along the edge of the ceiling there. That's where the bats come in. Some bats fly south in the winter to relax and be snowbirds, but there are four species of bat. They tend to hibernate here in the Northland, and so they look for places to hibernate where they're not going to freeze to death over the winter. There are a few low spots, so we're going to just take a little duck down here. We are in a completely different space now. We're underground. Oh, this must be 15 feet tall, the ceilings here. All around us, we're seeing kind of a flowing forms of limestone that are being dissolved. It's very damp in here because water is a part of what's going on that created this cave and continues to shape it. Do you see those cages under the stairway? We're making research accessible for the DNR and their partners to actually study possible solutions to the white nose syndrome. It's a fungus that's in this cave, and it makes their skin itch. It makes them wake up. And in the middle of winter, then they start flying around looking for something to eat, and they just don't have the calories stored for them to be able to fly around. There is nothing to eat down here in the winter, and most of them have starved as a result of being awoken. One of the things we do is just help people to be aware of bats and what bats need and why bats are good and what people can do for bats. But, you know, a lot remains to be seen about how the bats will do with this fungus in the environment. Will they develop a resistance to it? Is that why some of the bat populations in Wisconsin are coming back in the last year? We don't know yet. Okay, here we go. We're just about at the end of the cave now. And if we go down to the very end here and look over the edge, you will see that is a pool of water right there. A lot of people have never seen anything like this before. And kids who get the chance to come down here are really wowed by it. You know, what a great way to introduce them to some of these ideas about conservation.
WPR's Hope Kerwin took us on a tour of the Kickapoo Caverns. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Divorce rates in the U.S. have been on the decline in recent years, but within those separations, research out of UW-Madison showed a shift in the placement of children from those divorces. Back in the 1980s, just 2% of divorces in Wisconsin resulted in equal joint custody of children. The vast majority of divorces had one parent gain sole custody, maybe with visitation rights. Jump ahead to the 2010s, that number jumped up about a third of divorces leading to joint custody. Other studies have shown similar trends nationwide. But a lot of our social safety net and child support systems are still designed with one household in mind. Our next guest researches family characteristics and public policy. He's here to help us learn more about how these custody systems work and how they could be improved. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one gone through a child custody split? What was that experience like? What do you think of the current child support system? And if you're in a family with joint and equal custody, has that created difficulties in dealing with things like bureaucracy at any level? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Quentin Reiser is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. Quentin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
And thank you for having me.
Quentin, when a couple is getting divorced or a non-married couple with kids is splitting up, what are the factors that go into determining custody placement of children?
Yeah, so I always sort of begin from this premise that courts and families sometimes make decisions around where a child should be placed in the event of a divorce or a separation. And there are a lot of factors. One you can imagine is how well off the family is. So a lot of times when we think about this phenomenon of shared care increasing over time, and you cited the statistic that talked about equal care, but when we think about joint physical custody, whether it be symmetric, which is roughly 50-50, or asymmetric, where both parents have at least 25% of their time with the child, but it's some sort of variation on 50-50, maybe 45-55. That has increased from roughly 12.5% to roughly a third, as you said. And now, and if we looked at those data, most recent data show that over half of custody arrangements in the U.S. are shared. And so it's true that when we think about shared custody, there's this selection effect where traditionally more affluent, more highly educated parents selected into this arrangement. And one of the reasons that you could think that might be true is because this arrangement, the shared care arrangement, is a costly arrangement. You can think about fixed costs such as housing. If the child's going to have a bedroom in parent A and parent B's home, well, then that duplicates the cost, essentially. There's actually data from Australia that estimates that a shared care child is roughly 70% of a child in each home. And so now you have like 1.5 children with the same level of income, presumably, for both parents. So income is one factor that is a consideration when parents are opting for one custody arrangement or the other. One important dimension that I think about in my research is the extent to which the parents can cooperate. I think custody type notwithstanding, that cooperation or conflict is critical in shaping developmental outcomes, and we can get a bit more into that later. So it's really the things that come up immediately when you ask that is, you know, how well off is the family? Are they a family of means? And how well do the co-parents get along, essentially?
Well, that's interesting because that means, in effect, there's a built-in inequity on that. If you have, let's suppose, a lower-income couple who do get along and would love to have equal custody of their kids, there might just straight up be a financial impossibility. They couldn't afford together to maintain two households big enough to support those kids.
Certainly. And so you can, and I think a lot of it, what we would point to is those fixed costs like housing. I mean, certainly there are time dependent costs such as food or, I mean, maybe utilities depending upon how much, you know, water, I guess, or what have you that the child is using when they're staying in your home. But, lower income families would often struggle at times to maintain one household. And so when you break into two households and you lose sort of these economies of scale, it becomes much more difficult to sustain that arrangement. And I think it's also important to point out that lower income families are not really always what we're talking about when we conduct these studies on joint physical custody. And that's mainly because lower income families are more likely to cohabitate than to marry. And so when we're thinking about the cohort of families that have been divorced, I mean, this is already of the baseline of families that have children, sort of a more socioeconomically advantaged group compared to the counterparts who cohabitate. And so always, too, it's important to kind of note that while there's this sort of positive selection, as I've suggested, into shared care relative to sole care, such that those that enter into the shared care arrangement typically have higher incomes and are more educated, there's actually a negative selection into divorce, right? Such that those who divorce have lower incomes and are commonly less educated than their counterparts who remain in stable marriages. And so it's a really complex dynamic to study these phenomenon of divorcing and separating parents and how children should fare in each of these arrangements when you think about all of the possibilities. So it's something that, you know, that we all try to disentangle.
Talking to Quentin Reiser, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison, about joint custody of children. How it works differently, maybe at different income levels in our country. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Quentin, I wonder, with families who are not married, you know, cohabiting, maybe raising kids, when they separate, they're not married, so they don't get divorced. Are there cases where, hey, we're just figuring out our child raising system without going to the courts and maybe without researchers being able to research it?
Well, that is true, yes, but it's also true among shared care families. It's true. In some data, we worked on a study. This was actually an international comparative study, contrasting data from Wisconsin, which represented the U.S. in this case, and Finland. And we assessed the extent to which shared care families, relative to sole care families, shared an array of expenses. And we looked at, like, expenses such as hobbies and health insurance and a series of expenses, and asking the question, do shared care families share expenses? But a part of that study that we assessed was, are shared care families more likely or less likely to have a formal child support agreement? Or do they sort of, as you suggested about maybe lower income families that are cohabitating, handle things among themselves? And it's true that shared care families, as we found, are more likely to kind of handle things among themselves. And when you think about lower income families, and potentially parent A or parent B, attempting to support the child or attempting to establish a level of time with the child, there is also some of that we see. That's not something that empirically I've investigated, but there are others that have that suggest that, yes, sometimes it is more arm's length than it is, let's get the courts involved in determining legal and physical custody arrangement.
We're talking to UW-Madison Human Development and Family Studies Professor Quentin Reiser about an increase in joint child custody, how it fits into child support and other systems. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you dealt with this in your life? Did you come up with an amicable shared custody arrangement with the help of courts or without? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Quentin Reiser, Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison, looking at how our social safety net systems work for children in different custody arrangements after their parents separate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Brian is with us in Rice Lake. Brian, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I just wanted to share my experience 5 years ago during my divorce. I filed for I filed for placement of my daughter, and I also filed for child support. And what I found in Barron County here where I live is that when I filled out the forms, I really couldn't. We had to edit the forms so that we had to scratch out wife, mother, because there was nowhere for male husband, you know, father to put his name on the form when we submitted it. And I also felt when I was in court, I had an experience with the judge and said, hey, sure is really great, you know, that a man wants to have his child. And he applauded me, and then he further insulted me by saying, and it sure is great that a man would want to have his daughter. And I just, It really hurt my feelings.
Brian, I'm sorry to hear that. Thank you for sharing that experience. Quentin, as I understand in American history, there was early on a presumption that the father would get custody, then for a long period, the mother. And Brian, in very recent history, facing that presumption, even on the forms he had to fill out.
Right. And that is so true. And a lot of what we track the trends in the uptick of shared custody to is, I don't think Brian's example necessarily highlights this, but a move and a change in sort of social and legal perspectives, courts preferring joint custody. For a long time, Wisconsin has been sort of more progressive than the nation in pursuing this sort of joint physical custody as a presumption. And it's kind of dovetailed with a cultural shift that recognizes the import of father involvement in child rearing and a push for, you know, more balanced roles after divorce. And that's you sort of in line with what some of our sort of EU counterparts have done for quite some time in thinking about sort of the mother and the father as having sort of more equivalent roles to be earners or laborers, if you will, and carers, both responsible for bringing income into the home and both responsible for caring for the child, sort of a more egalitarian perspective. And so I think the trend suggests that there will come a time, hopefully soon, where that is not the interaction that fathers have with the system, and that you're not congratulated for doing what you feel you ought to do to care for your child, for sure. But I think I've interacted with a lot of fathers who echo your sentiments, and I think that's something that should be hopefully, you know, phased out based on the data that we see and the trends and the commonality of fathers like you who really want to care for their children.
Thanks a lot, for that call, Brian. Aaron joins us now in Milwaukee. Aaron, hi.
Hi there. I'm just wondering, so as the stats show that your guest is referencing, as sort of this whole family court system moves toward the presumption of joint custody being in the best interest of kids, I'm wondering if your guest has any ideas on special considerations in cases of domestic violence. So particularly when you hear from survivors about being in really unsafe custody arrangements where they're sharing custody with an abusive ex-partner, and even in cases in which there are criminal convictions against the other parent, I think when one parent brings up a legitimate concern about violence or abuse or safety, they are often viewed by the family court system as high conflict or told in an explicit way that they should not be bringing these concerns up. Just wondering what your guest had to say on that issue.
Aaron, thanks. An important point, Quentin. How does domestic violence figure into these decisions?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And a lot of times when we write about these issues, we write, you know, shared care is a presumption. And, you know, courts would lean in that direction, except in the cases would be the hope of domestic violence, or except in the case where parent A or parent B, for whatever reason, weren't going to be able to interact with their child or the associated parent in a sort of more reasonable way. And so I think, like I said, parental conflict is, and that's not domestic violence per se, but parental conflict is such an important dimension. And so insofar as a parent has demonstrated a level of abuse or violence, I mean, you could imagine that would impact your level of agreement on various issues. I would say that is a situation where the recommendations should lean in the direction of a sole custody arrangement wherein parent A or parent B, the custodial parent, you know, cared for the child at least 75% of the time.
Aaron,
so I think there's certain cases where sole custody makes a lot of sense. And we can talk, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages to both, even outside of looking at domestic violence cases. And you know, the literature is actually quite mixed as to what type of custody arrangement lends to, you know, improvements in outcomes. Anyway, so there's a lot to unpack that we can unpack.
Aaron, thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last minute or so, Quentin, I wanted to ask about, we saw some of you and your colleagues' work referenced in an Atlantic article that pointed out, you know, the data you have, the increase in joint custody, but the rest of the world, the rest of our system not keeping up, and the idea that, you know, the schools want to deal with one address, and child support and public assistance programs want to deal with one address. Just briefly, our system's keeping up with this increase in joint custody.
The short answer is no, they're not keeping up with this. So when you look at most cross-national or within country data sets, when you look at, you know, OECD data or census data, a lot of times when we're tracking children, we're sort of allocating them to one home. Like, what home is the residence of this child? There's one. So in a shared custody arrangement, you can imagine if it's an equal sort of split care that it would stand to reason that maybe this child should be, you know, 50% of this home for the sake of, you know, taxes, for the sake of economic supports, child maintenance, and 50% in this home. But our systems currently allow for a child to be in one place at one time. And you can think of all of the sort of negative implications for one parent or the other parent when you can only sort of count the child in one place in a given time frame. And so I think you can imagine the administrative burden and the sort of complex calculus that would come along with sort of splitting a child between homes, sort of proportionally. But I think it's sort of necessary to ensure that parents have, you know, the supports they need in order to rear children. And kind of briefly here,
just a few moments left.
Okay. Yeah. And so like when you think about custodial parents, they have access to multiple supports. You know, they have access to child tax credits and earned income tax credits and WIC and TANF and child support enforcement services, SNAP. And when you look at non-custodial parents, they generally don't have access to much. They're honestly treated by our systems as non-parents.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to Quentin Reiser with UW-Madison's Department of Human Development and Family Studies, looking at an increase in children under joint parental custody. More than 90% of Wisconsin fire departments are staffed partially or entirely by volunteers, but for the last three decades, the number of volunteer firefighters around the country has been declining. In recent years, the state's fire departments and technical colleges have turned to high school students with the hope that training teens early on will lead to a lifelong interest in the field. Hope Kerwin talked with some of the students who hope to be the next generation of firefighters.
Jaden Matheson is a senior at Onalaska High School. For much of her life, her dad has been a firefighter.
Like, I hear about the stories that he goes through, and I think they're so cool, and I hear about all the lives he saved.
Matheson wants to pursue her own career in firefighting, and if all goes well, she'll take the state certification exams for firefighters and emergency medical responders before she even graduates in the spring. She's enrolled in the Youth Firefighter Training Program through Western Technical College and the Onalaska Fire Department. High school students from around the region spend the first part of their school day attending class at the city's fire station. Matheson says her friends at school think she's crazy for wanting to be a firefighter, but she's ready to get started.
I sit on TikTok and I watch all the firefighting videos and I'm like, ooh, that looks really fun. Like the adrenaline rush, I really want to go into that.
On a cold morning at the end of October, Matheson and her classmates are finally ready to face a real fire for the first time. Instructors from the technical college walk them through the burn tower, a collection of steel shipping containers that create a multi-story training course. Then the students crowd into one of the rooms and turn on their air tanks as the practice fire is lit. They take off a glove for a moment to feel the heat from the blaze. And an instructor talks them through the different stages of a fire as smoke fills the room.
You see what I'm saying? About the fog and the headlights? I can't see nothing. I can't see you guys. What stage do we have?
Matheson and her classmate Rhett Stensley from Westby Area High School say the experience is both exciting and daunting.
It was kind of scary at first.
Nerve-wracking, not being able to see your hand right in front of your face. I mean,
because the smoke buildup, it's just crazy because you can't see anything.
Very exciting, very exciting.
Tyler Ludeking from Western Technical College says the live fire training is an important step for the students, allowing them to put into practice what they've learned in class. And getting the experience while still in high school gives them the opportunity to see if their interest in firefighting holds up under the realities of the job.
They're really able to confirm that they do have an interest in fire, or they're able to confirm that maybe they don't anymore, but they still want to go into other areas in public safety.
Ludeking says interest in the youth program has grown over the last 3 years, both from students and fire departments who are hoping to one day recruit the teens in their area. He says the hope is that even students who pursue another career path will still put their training to use.
I think about students who are going to two-year technical or four-year college, for them to be able to say, hey, at the same time, I'm going to be maybe a volunteer firefighter in my off time, you know, that's a really good career opportunity for them.
But even if the teens stick with firefighting after graduation, not all of them want to staff Wisconsin communities. Stensley is one of them.
I want to do wildland firefighting to begin with and then eventually make my way to a department in some city, I'm hoping, get out of the Midwest a little bit.
Stensley says he hadn't thought about a career in firefighting until someone referred him to the youth program. He says the tight bond shared with his classmates has been the best part of the class, and he's found a sense of purpose in the work.
Spread positivity, help people on their worst days. I mean, that's why I'm doing this.
After going through the day's training, Matheson still has the same excitement about becoming a firefighter, even while acknowledging that facing a real fire is intimidating. She knows that this is a tough field.
You're going to see all the traumatic situations and, like, car accidents, babies and animals and just, like, older people, and I feel like that's going to be the most difficult.
She's one of the students who plans to stay in the state and is already looking at fire departments in northern Wisconsin, where she can work full-time after going through Western's Associates Program. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, check out great folk music from 2023 with WPR's own Sheila Shigley. And if you are a fan of the genre yourself and have a favorite musician from Wisconsin or from around the world, email now, ideas@WPR.org with that recommendation. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Far out in space, 19 million miles away from Earth, a NASA spacecraft sent a message vital to the future of long-range communications in space. The message? A cat video featuring a cat named Taters. According to a statement from the Jet Propulsion Lab, NASA's Deep Space Optical Communications Project beamed a message via laser from the Psyche spacecraft to a receiver on Earth. The goal, they want to figure out the best way to send detailed data-rich communications back from space, things like high-resolution video. So if you're going to send a video, why not use a cat video? That video shows Taters the cat chasing the light from a laser pointer. Now, to be clear, Taters was not in space. This is a video originally filmed here on planet Earth. The mission was a success. The engineers didn't have to wait through a 30-second insurance ad to watch the video. Space cat news you can use. This is Central Time.